From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We've all heard about the threats to our oceans, from overfishing, pollution, and global warming. But what is the way forward, the solution? National Geographic Explorer-in-Residence Enrique Sala is a marine ecologist on a mission. He travels the world to make the case for protecting ocean reserves, those underwater paradises teeming with marine life. This hour on Point, Saving the Oceans with marine ecologist Enrique Sala. You can join us on air or online. Can the oceans be saved? Can one man, this man, be the one to get the world on board? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me from Washington, Enrique Sala, marine ecologist and National Geographic Explorer in Residence. He heads National Geographic's Pristine Seas Project and is author of Pristine Seas, Journeys to the Ocean's Last Wild Places. How nice to have you with us, Enrique.
Hello, Jane.
So what is an Explorer in Residence? What does that mean? What do you do?
Well, the in-residence thing sounds like an oxymoron. So I try to be in residence as little as possible.
Right.
But basically, the Explorers in Residence is a program at National Geographic that allows a small group of explorers on different disciplines, oceans, archaeology, paleontology, to develop projects that would not be possible without the support of the National Geographic Society as an umbrella organization.
Hmm. So you're a highly respected marine biologist, obviously. You traded in the security and the intellectual freedom of a tenured post at Scripps to be an explorer in residence. What is it that you're fighting for? Why was this so important to you?
Well, I was born on the Mediterranean coast of Spain, watching the documentaries of Jacques Cousteau on television. And I was fascinated by what Jacques Cousteau showed us. Incredible wildlife, richness, biodiversity, whales, sharks, coral reefs, sea lions. But when I was swimming in the Mediterranean of my childhood, I saw none of that. The Mediterranean Sea was empty. And I was, as I continued my career and studied marine biology and became a professor, my job was to study the impacts of humans in the ocean, the impacts of fishing, pollution, climate change. And it was very depressing. Because one day I realized that what I was doing was just writing the obituary of ocean life. So I felt like the doctor who's telling the patient how she's going to die with excruciating detail, but not offering a cure. So that day I decided that I wanted to work on the cure. So I quit academia and proposed this crazy idea to National Geographic, the Pristine Seas Project, to try to inspire leaders to protect the wildest places left in the ocean.
So how much of our oceans are protected then right now?
Right now, only about 2% are fully protected from fishing and other human activities, which is very, very small compared to the 14% that is protected on land.
How much do you feel needs to be protected if we've got 2% fully protected now?
The target of the United Nations is 10% of the ocean protected by 2020. Scientific studies recommend that at least 20% should be protected. And last year, 2 years ago, the International Union of Conservation of Nature, which is an ensemble of conservation organizations from all around the world, agreed that we should think of protecting 30% of the ocean by 2030.
Hmm. So a UN goal of 20%, others up at 30%, is that possible? Do you see that as a possibility in the future?
It seems really, really difficult because right now we have only 2% of the ocean fully protected, and half of that has been achieved in the last couple of years. Hmm. So we have seen the protection, the creation of the largest marine reserves on the planet, and it seems that we have achieved the impossible. Yet, we still have to multiply our successes by five. So it seems very, very difficult, but there is momentum, there is visionary leadership, and there are more and more examples of the benefit of protecting large areas of the ocean. So I am optimistic that we will get to at least to our 10% target around 2020.
Mm. I misspoke. It is 10%, not 20%, the UN goal. Define the pristine ocean that you know. And what's the difference between pristine oceans and the oceans that most of us would recognize today?
Yeah, when I was a kid, I thought that the MTC was natural. That was my baseline, right? That's our perception of what's natural is imprinted on ourselves the first time we see something or the first time we get in the ocean. And I had been to beautiful places after I grew up and I became a diver. And I thought that I had seen really, really healthy places until I went to a pristine coral reef for the first time. That was Kingman Reef, 1,000 miles south of Hawaii. I remember the first time we dived there. We got to this atoll that barely breaks the surface. So you see these breakers in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, thousands of miles from land. You jump in the water, and as soon as your bubbles clear, we were surrounded by 10, 12, 15 gray reef sharks. Mm. Then the red snappers came to check us out. And then when the fish cleared out of our sight, we could see this vibrant, healthy coral reef that I had never seen anywhere else. So it was like getting in a time machine and going back 1,000 years.
Mm. So these are fish that are swimming toward you, not swimming away from you, like we typically see.
Yes, that's something that is, you know, I felt like what Darwin must have felt when he went to the Galapagos for the first time and saw that animals don't run away from you in a pristine place. And I just came back from the Galapagos. We were there on an expedition in December, and I could experience this once again. You know, there are places out there where the animals barely see humans, and they come to check you out.
So what did you find in the Galapagos?
The Galapagos is one of the most extraordinary places on the planet. Imagine swimming with penguins in the equator. You know, you are in tropical water, very warm, and there you have these little penguins. And there are cormorants that have very little wings that are useless for flying. So these cormorants are flightless. They can only dive. But they don't have natural predators, so they don't need the wings. And then you have the giant tortoises on land, animals that can live way over a century, and schools of 50 to 100 hammerhead sharks swimming over you. It's one of these extraordinary places where you can see what the ocean was like before we started degrading it at a global scale.
So you're 7 years into your tenure with National Geographic. What have you accomplished so far?
We've had some incredible experiences. We've conducted scientific research and published scientific papers and produced documentaries for the National Geographic Channel, but the main achievement has been that we have been able to inspire leaders to protect some of these places. And we have been to 16 pristine places so far in the last 7 years, and 8 have been already protected. And
these
eight of them, and they include some of the largest marine reserves on the planet, totaling over 3 million square kilometers, which is about 6 times the size of Spain, where I'm originally from, or the size of Alaska, Texas, California, New Mexico, and Montana altogether.
Mm. It's pretty good success. What does a trip involve? You work with a rather large team, do you not?
Yeah, the way we work is we have conducted this global study where we have identified what are the wildest, most pristine places in the ocean. And some of these places, we know they are pristine because there are some scientific studies showing that they are pretty healthy and unimpacted by humans. But for some other places, there is really no scientific information, no photographs, no videos. So we hope they are going to be pristine, and we go there hoping to find something extraordinary. And then we conduct these expeditions. And on the expeditions, it was kind of the Jacques Cousteau's Calypso. You know, my dream was to be a diver in Jacques Cousteau's boat, but I was born too late for that. But now I am doing it, you know, I am doing it myself with an incredible team of scientists and filmmakers. So we have a team that is in charge of collecting scientific data to measure how healthy, how pristine that place is, and to see how, you know, globally valuable and unique that place is. And then we have a team of filmmakers that produces compelling images. They produce compelling films that then we use to inspire the leaders of the countries that own these places to protect them.
And so how open are these governments to you?
Well, it's not just me. You know, I'm here speaking for the project, but you know, this is a team effort and we collaborate with other organizations. And so far, the leaders of these countries have been very, very receptive. We have not been told no yet. And 8 places have been protected. 2 more are going to be protected, hopefully, this year. And we are working on a few more. And you know what it takes? It takes for the leaders, be it the president, prime minister, foreign minister, it takes the leaders to have a first-hand experience. When a president has been with us in the field or has dived in one of these areas, or when we have been able to have a private screening with one of these leaders showing them what we found underwater, that completely changes their emotional connection to that place. And this is something very, very important. We have to not just provide scientific data to make sure that there is a rationale for protecting these places, but also we need to make this emotional connection that we can make only by taking people there or by showing them compelling documentaries.
The experience. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. These are the sounds of waves from a documentary that Enrique Sala helped put together for the government of Ecuador. We're talking this hour about what it will take to save our oceans, and you can join the conversation. Fishermen, do you worry about the future of your industry? Could ocean reserves be the answer? Does it take a new Jacques Cousteau to make us care? Our guest this hour, Enrique Sala, heads National Geographic's Pristine Seas Project. He's author of Pristine Seas, Journeys to the Ocean's Last Wild Places. He has been called the Jacques Cousteau of a new generation. Let's hear from Jacques Cousteau, the ocean conservationist. Here he is quoting from the poem The Triumph of Time by Algernon Charles Swinburne.
I will go back to the great sweet mother, mother and lover of man, the sea. I will go down to her, I and none other, close with her, kiss her, and mix her with me.
Joining me now from Santiago, Chile, is Foreign Affairs Minister Geraldo Muñoz. In October, Chile created the largest marine reserve in the Americas, protecting an area of about 115,000 square miles. Minister Muñoz, well, thank you for being with us. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Jane.
Well, I understand that the Secretary of State, John Kerry, was instrumental in your meeting, Enrique Sala. How did that come about?
Well, I think it was June 2014, John Kerry invited me to participate as the only keynote speaker from Latin America in a high-level segment of the conference Our Ocean in Washington, D.C. And there, he mentioned the Desventuradas Islands in the north of Chile, the rich biodiversity surrounding it and the pristine seas. And then I found out that Enrique had for National Geographic, had done a great documentary on the islands. So I met Enrique at that time. From that point on, I became extremely interested in the islands, and I actually flew to the islands and was able to see firsthand what was truly portrayed beautifully by Enrique and his collaborators in these islands that are pristine seas and should remain so.
And so you made the decision to protect 115,000 square miles around San Ambrosio and the San Felipe Islands. I guess you visited.
Right.
You visited the islands.
Yeah.
You watched the documentary that Enrique made of the islands. What did you see in that documentary and on your trip that convinced you to create the reserve?
The documentary showed the huge biodiversity surrounding those islands. I just didn't know that below the ocean there were the richness of turtles and all kinds of marine species that some of them were unknown until then. Mm. So I decided that we had to do something about it. And at the second Our Ocean Conference, the one that followed the June 2014 in Washington, we decided to organize it in Valparaiso in Chile. Mm. And at that time, we announced the creation of the Nazca Desventurados Marine Protected Area, as you said, about 115,000 square miles around the two islands, covering much of the economic zone of the oceanic islands of San Felix and San Andreas. So we're very happy about that, and that rich biodiversity will continue to be for the present and future generations.
Well, it's an interesting approach, isn't it, what Enrique Sala is doing with his teams. Do you think that if more government leaders like yourself saw what was in the waters off of their coastlines, they'd actually do something to preserve it?
I think so, yeah. And maybe Enrique should meet with a lot of other foreign ministers and presidents and so that they find out that they have to preserve and conserve their oceans, because oceans are fundamental, not only because they are part of our territorial or economic zones, but actually because they are good for humanity. Mm. They are sinks for carbon, and thus they play a fundamental role in climate change. And in addition to that, they provide food, and they are fundamental for coastal communities. So this is not only a contribution that one would make nationally, but globally, and not only for the present generation, for the future. So I think doing documentaries and extending the work that National Geographic has done and Enrique, I think would be good for everyone. Mm.
Enrique Sala, the State Department has been a strong ally of yours. I mean, obviously you have a friend there in the Foreign Affairs Minister of Chile. Are there other governments that have been less receptive, you know, places like China and India and Russia?
Yes. Well, first I would like to say hi to Minister Muñoz and thank him again for his hello. I really have to admire what he has done. And, you know, Chile went from almost no protection in the ocean 5 years ago to 12% of their waters protected. Mm. And under Minister Muñoz's leadership, Chile, last year in October at that Our Ocean Conference in Chile, they tripled the protected area in Chile, and they have plans for more. And I only wish that other leaders had the same vision, because as he said, you know, this is not just for conservation of marine life. This has a series of benefits for all of us, and not only nationally, but internationally. And other leaders are, for example, as you mentioned, Secretary Kerry has been instrumental in inspiring other leaders. But as an example, President Obama created the largest protected area on the planet a couple of years ago. And when you think of governments who are unlikely to create protected areas, like in my native Spain, for example, it would be impossible to create anything as large as what Chile has done. Mm. And we have decided to work only in places that are healthy enough and with governments that are visionary enough to create some of these large protected areas, because at this point in history, we need quick, big, big wins. So we want to be working next to leaders who understand their historical legacy.
Well, Foreign Affairs Minister Geraldo Muñoz, thank you so much for your time today, sir.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And Enrique will tell you that we're also working on Easter Island, which would be another challenge for the future. So this is not over. We will have to have more marine protected areas and contribute that way to the present and future generations. Thank you.
Thank you, Geraldo Muñoz, Foreign Affairs Minister from Chile. That is an interesting new project, the Easter Island Project. What was it, about 278,000 square miles of refuge proposed there?
Yeah, that could be another of the big marine reserves on the planet. And the government of Chile is committed to create some marine reserve in consultation with the local Rapa Nui community, and they are now in discussions, and let's hope that the community will want to create another large reserve that will benefit them.
Are there economic incentives for these countries, Enrique?
Absolutely. So think right now, 98% of the ocean is unprotected, right? And most of it is open access with very, very little regulation. So think of this as a bank account where everybody withdraws, but nobody puts money in. So you don't need to be an economist to figure out what's going to happen to that bank account. Mm. Now, these no-take reserves set aside are like savings accounts, because if you don't kill the fish, they take a longer time to die. They grow larger. They reproduce more. And after a few years, there are so many fish inside these reserves, and they produce so many offspring that some of these offspring moves, spills over the boundaries of these reserves. Mm. And the fishermen, and we have now economic data from hundreds of places around the world where local fishermen are catching better and they are increasing their income around these reserves. So these reserves are like savings accounts with a principal that produces interest that the fishermen can enjoy. Mm. And it's not only about fishing, because when the fish come back, the divers come in. Mm. And tourism has become a great incentive. And just to give you two examples very quick, one is the small reserve of the Medas Islands in the Costa Brava of Spain, where I did most of my doctoral research. It's a 1 square kilometer reserve. It's just the size of a few city blocks. That little reserve has the largest abundance of fish in the Mediterranean and brings so many tourists that they provide 10 million euros. They bring in 10 million euros to the local economy every year. 1 square kilometer of ocean, 10 million euros. Mm.
Well,
and at
incentive.
The other extreme, it's a huge incentive. And then think about the big one. The big one is a great example I like of the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park, this large protected area, a third of which is no take in Australia. That reserve, that park, provides 56,000 jobs and brings almost $5 billion Australian dollars in tourism. That's 25 times more. In the case of the Barrier Reef, it's 40 times more than what fishing brings.
A lot of calls here, Enrique Sala, people that want to get in and speak with you. Let's go to Miami, Florida. Lobster Pete is on the line. Lobster Pete, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi. Nice to talk to you. I'm a recreational diver in Florida. I've been diving these reef areas for about almost 50 years. And I've noticed a steady decline in fish populations. But I was diving yesterday, and I'm totally shocked at the coral bleaching that's been taking place. I've seen this happen about 20 years ago, where during the summer when all the corals turn white and appear like they're going to die. But then they did a quick comeback during the winter. But this year, like I said, I went diving yesterday. The coral is still bleached out. The water is exceptionally warm. And
so the bleaching, Lobster Pete, thank you. I think we've lost you. Enrique Sala, the bleaching been happening in the summers, now apparently happening in the winter. Probably doesn't surprise you.
Yes. So when you think about human impacts, we have local impacts like local pollution, development, destruction of the coast, fishing. And then we have these global impacts that are much more difficult to tackle, like global warming, climate change that makes the ocean warmer and more acidic. And if you protect the place from fishing, let's say, that does not protect the place from getting warmer. So we have been to some of these pristine places in the middle of nowhere. And after an El Niño year, like this year, where the water in the Pacific gets warmer than usual for too long, the corals bleach, they become white, and then they die. What we have seen, though, is that in places that are fully protected and in pristine places that have all the life in them, from the smallest to the largest, the places that have all the top predators like the sharks in abundance, these places are more likely to recover from those warming events. So it is like you're sick and you have 5 diseases, you're going to be in bad shape. But if you have only one disease, you'll be better able to cope with that one. So if we are able to eliminate or reduce direct human impact like fishing and development in some areas, we will make these areas more resilient, more likely to bounce back from these warming events. So
You talk about overfishing, you talk about global warming. There's one pollution we haven't discussed, and that's the pollution from plastics, which is a huge one and very difficult to overcome.
Plastics really, really scare me. Climate change scares me, and plastics scare me a lot. Because right now, over 8 million tons of plastic go into the ocean every year. And 8 million tons, people might think, what's that? Well, just let me give you an example. We have been to the most remote places in the ocean, in the Arctic, in the middle of the Indian Ocean, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, places that if you put these places in the middle of the map on Google Earth, all you see is ocean. You don't see any land. Hundreds, if not thousands of miles away from the mainland of the continents. And we have collected water samples that then we have sent to a lab in Maine. And in every one of these samples, we have collected hundreds of water samples. In every one of these samples, we have found microplastics. So the ocean right now, the global ocean, is a plastic soup.
Where's that plastic coming from?
About 80% of the plastic in the ocean comes from the land. And the rest, that the other 20%, comes from boats and fishing activities. And the Ocean Conservancy has commissioned some studies showing that most of it comes from China, India, Vietnam. As Southeast Asia is the biggest producer of plastic that ends up into the ocean.
Let's go to Mark in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Mark, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I have a question for Henrik about the harvesting of the large scallops in the South China Sea. I'm sure you may have seen it. There's an article from the BBC back in December where their reporter actually got in the water where they're just destroying the entire ecosystem over there in the South China Sea off of the Philippine Islands. And nobody seems to be claiming the rights, or nobody seems to be able to stop them. Just want to know what his comment is on that.
Mark, thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mark. What's happening in the South China Sea is not the only example where fishing fleets are destroying the entire ocean bottom. And people are connected to whales and seals because they are mammals and we have this natural connection. And, fish are not, I wouldn't say that cod are as cuddly as panda bears. So not many people care about depletion of fish. And then when you think about giant clams and scallops and all these other species, people are still less attached to them. But what I can say is that removing all these species is not only destroying those coral reefs, but is also destroying the ability of the ocean to keep the water clean and healthy. And we have, I have this analogy. Imagine that you are about to board the plane and the flight attendant tells you 5 screws are missing from this plane. We don't know which screws these are. We don't know what their function is, but we can tell you that we have 5 screws left. Would you board that plane? Same thing with species. We are eradicating species whose function in the ecosystem we don't know. So we might be doing a bad service to ourselves.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. That's some composite sound collected over 10 years from all over the world by ecologist Bernie Krause, including humpback whales in Hawaii, killer whales off Vancouver Island, and a dozen species of fish in the Caribbean. All the sound was recorded underwater, in coral reefs, and in the open ocean. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about... with National Geographic Explorer-in-Residence Enrique Sala about saving the oceans this hour, and you can join the conversation. What is your ocean paradise? After hearing Enrique, are you inspired to support his efforts? Let's go back to the phones. A lot of callers here. Let's go first to Annette in Rockingham, Vermont. Hi, Annette. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Enrique. I want to thank you so much for having this subject today. I've been a scuba diver for about 35 years, and I've had the opportunity to dive with one of Jacques Cousteau's very good friends, Stan Waterman, and Enrique probably knows him as well. I've been to many protected and unprotected areas in the world diving, and I feel very fortunate to have experienced both, so that I feel strongly about what I'm seeing. And can the plastic situation is what I'd like to discuss first, and I just cannot believe one of the protected areas that I dive quite regularly in is Bonaire. Bonaire's a little island. It's part of the ABC Islands, where there's Aruba, Curacao, and Bonaire. So Bonaire's is pristine water, and it's protected. The fish are amazing. It's absolutely gorgeous, good, healthy coral, except for one problem. Diving off the coast of Bonaire, not too far, maybe only a quarter of a mile or so, I encountered a beautiful sea turtle acting strangely on the top of the water. Myself and my friend swam over to it, and underwater we were able to see what was wrong. It had a plastic Diet Coke, Coca-Cola bottle, plastic bottle in its mouth, and it was dying slowly because they eat jellyfish, and they probably thought it was a jellyfish. So we removed the Coca-Cola bottle, and I think that the turtle might live. However, this poor little island, just as we were speaking about the opening of all of this plastic coming onto these islands and the strong winds, they could have thousands of bottles that are flying off of cruise ships. I would really love to see, since cruise ships are so massive and they do have so much plastic on them, and it's on the oceans all over the world, I would love to see education of passengers. If we can't get the cruise ship companies to stop carrying plastic, I would love to see the education of the passengers. And a picture, I wish I had a picture of the Coca-Cola bottle in the turtle's mouth. That would have been perfect. But
yeah, it's a terrible sight, but it's a really interesting story, Annette. Thank you very much for calling. Enrique, you've probably seen a lot of that in your time.
Yes, I've seen marine mammals and sharks and turtles entangled on plastic nets, or even the wrapper of six-pack cans. And, you know, this is a big problem because plastic kills hundreds of thousands of seabirds, marine mammals, and sea turtles around the world every year. And it's very, very difficult to think of a cleanup of the entire ocean. The scale is so massive that what we need to do is to stop plastic getting into the ocean. And cruise ships are a big, big problem. These large cruise ships are not very environmental, despite what their greenwashing says. And everyone that has a business near the ocean should eliminate single-use plastic, because this is a big problem, and it's very easy to take care of.
What about, we talked about threats to our ocean environment. Talk about preservation on the high seas, where there is no government to negotiate with. What is the challenge associated with that?
That's exactly the problem, Jane, that no government is in charge. So when we have worked with the government of the US or the UK or Chile, you know, if the government makes a decision, then they take action. The problem is when you deal with the international waters that belong to everybody and belong to nobody, nobody is really in charge. And unfortunately, most of the decisions in the high seas, as are in the other United Nations forums, have to be done by consensus, unanimous consent. So it only takes a few nations that have a monopoly of fishing in the high seas to block, to veto any conservation proposal. there was a group, the Global Ocean Commission, that has been working for the last few years. And the group is formed by former political leaders. They have reached out to the United Nations and world leaders with a very clear plan of what should be done in the high seas. But unfortunately, again, a few nations like Spain and China and others are vetoing conservation actions that would benefit the rest of humanity.
So you could have 10 or 15 countries that are on board, and because you have to have unanimous consent, one says, I don't think so, and you're out of luck.
Exactly. This is why on our project Pristine Seas, we have been working with individual countries, because you have to deal only with one government, and countries own 200 nautical miles from their coast. So whatever happens in their waters is their responsibility. So this is their resource, and they have to take care of it. So it's much easier.
Here's Marilyn in Coconut Grove, Florida. Marilyn, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I wanted to get comments on my experience diving in the Republic of Palau near the Rock Islands. It was pristine when I was diving there, but the boat next to mine had people jumping off the boat and off the coral that was underneath, which, you know, they advise you to eternally don't step on it. But when I raised my concern with the guide, he said, oh, that's not a problem. We just don't want the people to be hurt.
Back to education. All right, Marilyn, thank you very much for the call there from Florida. Let's go to Atlanta, Georgia. Will is on the line. Will, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Fine. Thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to know if you'd done any research or countered during his research any of the effects of runoff from the land from human development. I noticed in the Keys a lot of times, even though it's a marine sanctuary, the effects of humans on the land, the runoff from water and fertilizers and sewage and things like that is just really tearing up the reefs there. And I was wondering if there was anything he could comment on what he's seen around the world like that.
Will, thank you. Enrique.
Yeah, there are many places around the world that are now called dead zones. There are 500 of such dead zones. The most famous is outside the mouth of the Mississippi River, where you have all this fertilizer runoff from upstream sources, from agricultural lands, that ends up in the ocean, because the ocean is downstream of everything. And this fertilizer creates these blooms of algae and bacteria that suck up all the oxygen and basically kill everything that cannot swim away. So these dead zones are destroying entire environments, and it's a real problem, and it has a clear solution. So everything we do on land is also affecting the sea. So if you are in the Midwest and you are a farmer and you use fertilizer, not only you are probably damaging your soil, but also you are having an impact downstream hundreds of miles away on the Florida Keys, for example.
Well, thank you for the call. I want to play some sound here. Coral reefs surround the island of Vanua-Levu in Fiji, some living and some in the process of dying or already dead, in fact. This recording was made by ecologist Bernie Krause underwater in October 1995 at a reef about 400 yards long. This part of the coral reef was quite alive. You can hear a lot of different types of fish, damselfish, clown, parrot, puffer, cardinal, goat, and butterfly fish. Here it is. And here is the same coral reef, but on the other end, where it was bleached and had very few fish. The recording again by Bernie Krause. That's so interesting, Enrique. A reef about 400 yards long could have such a different sound, such a different movement at either end.
Yes, we can see the impact of humans in very, very short distances. And when you dive in a marine reserve, you can see this very clearly, because most of the fish are inside the reserve and there is spillover of the fish, but most of the fishermen around them catch those fish within the first kilometer from the reserve. So there is a very strong boundary there. And, you know, you would think that the fish know that they are safe there. So, you know, small actions can have a huge impact in the ocean. And I love what Bernie did with the sounds, because this is something that people haven't paid attention to. Jacques Cousteau, when he published his first famous book, The Silent World, he was talking about how silent the ocean was compared to the human world. Unfortunately, now the ocean is becoming very noisy because of all these human activities, boats and sonar and industrial operations and seismic testing for oil exploration. And that's destroying the acoustic environment of the ocean and damaging also the marine mammals, for example, like whales that use sound in the ocean, use sound to communicate and to migrate and find mates. So we are depleting, we are changing the ocean in such a massive scale.
Another call from Connecticut. Jerry is on the line. Jerry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thank you so much for having this on today. Such an important topic. I have been diving for 43 years around the world, and in some of the most remote areas of the world, most recently off the Great Barrier Reef, but also in Micronesia, in the middle of the Pacific, and Bali in the Indian Ocean. And everywhere we go lately, we see vast fields of floating garbage. It's very dismaying. And Cousteau inspired my diving, and one of his great quotes was, "I am the sea, and the sea is me." I'd like the guests to comment on what we're doing to the future of humanity directly by killing off the biomasses in the ocean from the bottom to the top.
Jerry, thank you so much. Enrique.
Yes, well, imagine my life thinking about ocean conservation, ocean problems from morning to evening, and sometimes even while I'm dreaming. So it can be quite depressing, but there are solutions. So what we are doing is diminishing the ability of the ocean. We are not only removing marine life, but we are diminishing the ability of the ocean to provide all these goods and services that are critical to our existence. Mm. The ocean gives us more than half of the oxygen that we breathe. It regulates the climate. It is a good sink for carbon. It absorbs much of the carbon pollution that we put in the atmosphere. It provides livelihoods for hundreds of millions of people. But to be able to provide all this, you know, it's life. It's plants and animals that provide all these services. When we remove these plants and animals, we are reducing the quality and the quantity of these services. But the good news is that there are solutions. We know there are solutions that work. There are places where fisheries have been managed well, so the fisheries are sustainable. Marine protected areas, especially these no-take marine reserves, bring marine life back and help the fishermen and help the tourism industry. You know, there are solutions right now. There are success stories that we need to replicate elsewhere.
There are success stories, but they are few and far between. I mean, talk about the European boats that use sonar, and they're having a tremendous impact on oceans in West Africa.
Yes, West Africa is one of these frontiers where European and Asian countries are raping and pillaging. And the most of these West African countries get nothing but a small fishing fees in exchange for this raping. There is a great example in West Africa, the country of Gabon. Gabon is run by President Bongo, who realized the problems affecting the fisheries of this country, having European and Japanese and Chinese fleets coming, taking all the big fish and leaving nothing for the locals. So he decided to end all the illegal fishing and renegotiate the agreements, the fishing agreements with these foreign fleets. And right now, the foreign fleets fishing in Gabon or wanting to fish tuna in Gabon, they have to pay much bigger fees, and much of the fish has to be landed in Gabon and processed in Gabon, which provides employment for many Gabonese. So it only takes political will. And a big problem in West Africa and in other parts of the world is corruption. And corruption is an endemic issue with fisheries. There are corrupt fisheries officials everywhere around the world, and in, you know, more than in any other departments in governments, as far as I know. but the president of Gabon fired the entire fishing department. You know, unprecedented move. And that was the end of the corruption. So if there is political will and if there is leadership, and this is what we need these days, we need leadership with environmental vision, these problems can be solved.
Leadership, political will, you are trying desperately to preserve the world's oceans. You took four trips last year with much success. You're planning five trips this year. What do you see? Are you optimistic about what's ahead?
I am optimistic about some things. I am not about some others. There are species that are gone, that will never come back. There are species like some sharks that have been depleted by 99%. So in the last century alone, we have killed 99% of that species. So for this, I'm not optimistic. But I am very optimistic about the example that leaders like Secretary Kerry, President Obama, the government of Chile and others have shown us in the recent years, showing that countries can help to protect much of the ocean. So I hope that we'll be able to take advantage of this momentum.
Enrique Sala, explorer in residence at National Geographic and head of the Pristine Seas Project. He is author of Pristine Seas, Journeys to the Ocean's Last Wild Places. Thank you so much for coming on and good luck with your work.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation. Listeners, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, remembering the great David Bowie, the man, the music, the icon. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.